KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 13, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Lisa Loving and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Galatas, Farah Siddiqui, Jill Freitas, Suzanne Potter, and Roz Brown. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. Coming up on Sunday, February 18th, Don't Shoot Portland and Media Pollution are hosting a community art build at Pacific Northwest College of Art from 11 to 3 p.m. It's described as an opportunity to create powerful art that raises awareness and sparks conversation about important social issues. The art produced will be incorporated into Don't Shoot Portland's installation in the Policing Justice exhibition at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. The event was originally scheduled for MLK weekend, but it had to be moved because of the severe winter weather. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot Portland to learn more about the event.
This weekend is a big family-focused event in partnership with the Pacific Northwest College of Art. Teresa, that's so much. You guys do a lot.
Well, we have fun doing it. We got a lot of kids that expect us to show up, and they're organizing this stuff with us. So we're just excited to bring it back.
I want to hear more about the art workshop. Who's leading it, and what are we going to be doing there?
Awesome. Yeah. So since about 2017, we've been working with PNCA, the Pacific Northwest College of Art, to create protest signs, to create signs that are like responding to some of the ideas that the children have, whether it's like protect kids, not guns, or Black Lives Matter, or MLK, which this year would be MLK 95. Signifying the 95th birthday of Dr. King. But we made those signs because they would be a clear indicator during our march that there is a voice that wants to be heard. And they also issue a call to action. And so doing this with PNCA every year has not only activated our educators and our children, but also our communities. And it's really a good way to kind of like build community and to branch out our mutual aid advocacy as well, because we connect with families and we're able to kind of like advocate and provide them information about the services that we provide in community. Mm-hmm. And then we become an access point for those people that need us.
So to people, and I don't mean to make this sound childish, but so the people that want to go to this incredible art opportunity, they're going to get paint on them. They're going to get their hands dirty, right? We're not just looking and listening to somebody
paint.
Talk. Good.
And we have aprons. We're using acrylic paint. We're going to be using print blocks. We use a lot of different methods, because obviously PNCA is an art school, so they really know how to bring it. But yeah, we make some really amazing art. And I'm always encouraging the kids that when they make their designs and we print these arts, we're doing them by hand. So each one is rare. And what people don't realize is that over the last couple of years, we've sold signs to help like keep our programming alive. Mm-hmm. And the kids are fine artists, in our opinion, because they are making fine art in a fine art institution. So
right.
It's not only teaching them to be active, it's also letting them know that whatever they do to support the movement is very important to the world, you know.
And on that note, I want to say we're talking with Teresa Rayford, but we are keeping it real, and Teresa's watching her grandkids. So the kids are in the house. I mean, the kids are here. So just you know, get over it if that's distracting for you, because this is real life. And Teresa, like, the first time I ever met you, it was because you were advocating for a little boy and his mom. Why is this so focused on kids? I mean, I know that there's lots of other organizations that do incredible work, and they might be organizing people to vote or something like that. But with you, it always comes back to the kids, the little kids. Talk about that. Why do you do that?
Well, I want them to have the power of making demands. I want them to not only be sitting on the sideline while people are advocating for them, but I want to hear what they have to say. I grew up in foster care with my brothers and sisters, and we always had someone speaking on our behalf, but they never said the things that were very important for us. And so with the work that we do in the advocacy, not only providing like educational materials, like books that we distribute, but giving children the opportunity to express themselves with art, it's just important for them to know that their voice matters. It's so important, especially now, you know. I've witnessed over the last 10 years that by giving them this type of space to create, that they're becoming very astute organizers, that they're becoming independent thinkers, that they're becoming critical thinkers. And I think that's very important.
Especially since I'm always talking about innovation. I always have the sense that we don't really know what's going to happen in the future. We can imagine some of the things, but we don't really know. And when I hear people talking about empowering this community or bringing resources to that community, I just want to know that all the best and brightest people are getting their grassroots watered. That's what I want to know. And that's
Absolutely.
One of the things that strikes me about Don't Shoot Portland. One of the things that got my attention with Don't Shoot Portland a long time ago was your you know you guys actually you bring the fire, like you've taught local people in the local community how to be archivists, like museum quality archivists. And I want to talk about that a little later. When you guys were on this show last, you were about to do an important program about that, and I want to ask you about it in a few minutes. But just like back to the events that you're having this weekend, I just want to really nail like what people can expect, because I hope that a lot of people show up and make connections with others, because I think that that's really the key.
Absolutely. So we'll get there around 11 o'clock to start with art making. And so we'll be introducing the people that show up, the space where we're going to be making the art, and we'll be getting everybody outfitted for the for the job, wearing their aprons and letting them pick out what types of paints and things. And so they'll take a crash course in screen printing, which is really awesome, because I've met with some of the people after the fact, and they take the screen printing seriously. They take it home. It becomes a job. It becomes a business. It becomes a hobby, because, in fact, you know, burning the screens and creating the art from them is really not as hard as it sounds. But for us, making art accessible, not too expensive to make, not too expensive to have access to, is really why we coordinate this with PNCA. And I think they do an amazing job of teaching us how to actually make art with the screen printers and stuff like that. But we'll be doing that from 11. There'll be a snack break and, you know, restroom breaks and stuff like that throughout the day. And I'm hoping, again, that people will come out and ask the questions that they want to get the answers to, that they'll get information that maybe they hadn't known, or they'll learn ways to do research that will be easy and accessible for them to do at home or using social media. And, you know, just go away with some kind of fire under their, you know, situation in their hearts to kind of move for social change. In 2020, when I saw all those young people out there and I was at home battling, you know, asthma and, you know, looking at ways to keep people safe through our lawsuit, I realized that we didn't even have to be there with the children anymore all the time like we used to be. We didn't have to organize the response to oppression or discrimination or violence, because they already have learned some of those lessons that were intentionally being brought to them, even though they were children. And it's incredible how, you know, even to this day, people will talk about how, well, their kids are too young to learn about racism. They're too young to learn about state violence. Well, they're having those things happen to them in real life. And even if they're not affected directly by it, their peers that are watching are affected by it. You know, we can't sit back and think that if we change the channel, that the kids aren't going to get the information. We're not in the 70s and 80s anymore. Right. That channel is on their TikTok, right?
Yep. I have to also say, it cracks me up that you are having a screen printmaking workshop. That's free, right?
Absolutely. All of our programming is free, including the archiving programs that we do. And we provide it free because it's something that, you know, again, art should be accessible to everyone.
Right.
And what a lot of people don't know is that Don't Shoot Portland is an arts and education organization. So it's important for us to see a generation of artists and creatives having access to resources and spaces that support their expression.
One of the things that I love about the direction that Don't Shoot Portland has gone in the past number of years is that as you are, you're really ringing very sharp bells about how systems work, and you're not playing games with the political establishment, the legal establishment. And when it came down to, I feel like the riot, that I don't want to call it the riots of 2020. It's the police that declare something a riot. That's their language. I'm going to say the
and
civil
the
unrest.
And they're the ones who got sued.
Right.
Like the bad guys got sued.
So, but what I was going to say was you're really effective at bringing the right kind of pressure on the right kind of people. Can you, I know that this is kind of a, it's a little bit of an old story, I guess, in a way, but can you talk a little bit about the lawsuits that you brought after 2020? And can you talk about the tear gas stuff?
Oh, absolutely. And it's really not that old. It took so many years to get to a settlement, and we just had that happen in 23. And we're actually... Well, so I was at home, actually, at the time of the protest, and I was witnessing all of this. And one of my friends that was on the front line with her pregnant daughter had contacted me and said, hey, the police are using tear gas. They're doing all this. Do you know anything about how that works with COVID? Because, you know, like, it doesn't seem like they care about our safety at all. And I started getting really concerned because I couldn't breathe at the time, and I wasn't even at the protest. So I contacted Aria Mormon, who is a medical administrator, that helped me build a team of scientists and chemists and writers, mental health support writers, that were able to answer all of my questions in a science report. Thank you. In a science report. And we published it and used it with our lawyers to petition the courts not to use tear gas during this pandemic, because there wasn't enough research done on how the harm would affect the people that were quarantined for over 90 days, how it would affect people that were going through trauma or pregnant or children, you know? And so once we got this report out, we, you know, the injunctions were filed, they were approved, but the police violence continued. There was a federal response. There was another lawsuit after that. We stopped that. Fed home. and it was just, for me, it was critical not to fight people that were actually showing grief and coming together as community to address the trauma that the rest of the world was also dealing with. And I don't think it was just the fact that George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and all these people were getting hurt. It was the fact that we were still killing people during the pandemic.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving speaking with Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot Portland. This is an excerpt from the show Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving, which airs on Thursdays at 8 a.m. on KBOO. They discuss the community art build put on by Don't Shoot Portland and Media Pollution coming up this weekend. It's on Sunday, February 18th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Art at 511 Northwest Broadway. More information is online at don'tshootpdx.org. This has been KBOO News in Depth. Thanks for listening.
KBU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In this country, almost 99% of the meat and dairy we eat comes from industrialized factory farms. Now, despite what you may see in commercials and on food packaging, factory farms are a far cry from cows grazing in green bucolic pastures, chickens pecking away in the sunshine, and pigs wallowing in grassy fields. Instead, it means thousands of cattle standing shoulder to shoulder in concentrated feeding operations, often surrounded by piles of their own waste, pregnant pigs forced to live in metal crates for months at a time, and laying hens living in boxes that are so small they can't stretch out their wings. In the past few years, public pressure has resulted in a handful of states passing laws that make conditions for our food animals a little more humane. However, now there's pushback from meat-producing lobby and lawmakers in heavy meat-producing states. Their latest effort to counter those animal welfare laws is the EATS Act, which would effectively negate those laws and prevent others like them from being passed in the future. Here to talk with us about the EATS Act is Wayne Pacelli, president of Animal Wellness Action and Center for a Humane Economy. Thank you, Wayne, for taking the time to talk to us. And I want to ask you to start by explaining exactly what the EATS Act is, what it would do if passed, and why it's being pushed in Congress right now.
Yes, well, the EATS Act stands for Exposing Agricultural Trade Suppression Act. It's a real mouthful. And really, it's just the latest effort by the factory farming industry, in particular, the industrial pork industry, to unwind very modest state rules to give animals more space and to also restrict the sale of pork from operations that severely confine the breeding sows. The breeding sows, you know, for the last 40 or 50 years, most of them have been confined. Of the 6 million sows who are in the U.S. Pig breeding population, most of them have been confined in 2-foot by 7-foot cages called gestation crates. So these are basically the pre-birthing crates. So the sows are pregnant, and these are animals who can weigh 300, 400, 500, 550 pounds. And they are essentially immobilized in these crates for 4-month stretches, which is the period of their gestation. So they cannot turn around. They can barely take a quarter step forward. And these are intelligent animals. You know, they have the emotional intelligence and the general smarts of a dog. So if we did this to a dog and we put them in a crate barely larger than their body, for 4 months at a stretch, that would qualify as cruelty under many state anti-cruelty statutes. And the pork industry didn't like the reform efforts in Oregon, California, Colorado, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, other states that have banned these crates. And they were particularly agitated about California's Prop 12, which was passed overwhelmingly by voters in November 2018. It had a phase-in, and as of January 1, 2022, that measure was supposed to take full effect, and it would not only have expanded the space allotments for breeding sows in production facilities, but it would have stopped the sale of any pork that came from those factory farms that confined the sows. They challenged it, they being the pork industry, and they challenged it in the courts. They lost in the district courts. They lost in the appeals courts. They got this in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, much to the surprise of a lot of observers. And then this conservative U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that California exercised its proper authority in passing the statute. It did not invalidate Prop 12 like the National Pork Producers Council and the American Farm Bureau Federation wanted. That was a huge loss for them. We celebrated, as did many others who care about animals. And then immediately after that, the allies of the National Pork Producers Council and the Farm Bureau got legislation introduced in Congress called the EATS Act, and we've been battling away in the Congress since that introduction to thwart its advance.
You know, you touched on this when you were answering that question, but I do want to make the point that it's estimated that 1 in 4 pigs being raised for meat in the U.S. actually belong to Chinese-owned companies, and a lot of people may not realize that. In your opinion, how invested and powerful are these foreign interests in seeing the EATS Act get passed?
The pork industry or the pig industry is the biggest example of foreign-owned agriculture in the United States. Two foreign-owned companies control 40% of the U.S. Pig population. And the biggest one, or the bigger of the two, is Smithfield Foods, which was acquired by the Communist Party of China in 2013. It was enabled by a $5 billion loan from the Bank of China, which is a state institution. And now it is wholly controlled by the Chinese government. The second big actor is JBS, which is a Brazil-based company. We don't have precisely the same acute concerns about JBS as we do about the government of China. In China, what we're seeing are high-rise factory farms, as many as 29 stories high, with these, basically it looks like a giant condominium complex in New York City. And it's filled with pigs who never get out of these rooms. It's a farrow to finish operation. That is the kind of Brave New World image, very dystopian vision of agriculture. If Smithfield Foods, which is the biggest member of the National Pork Producers Council, achieves its goal of passing the EATS Act, we will wipe out state rules, and we will then enable the Chinese to build these giant industrial-style high-rise factory farms in the United States. Some people may say, oh, that's far-fetched, that couldn't occur. Who would have thought factory farming would have started, where you have thousands and thousands of animals standing shoulder to shoulder? This is just the souped-up model of the same enterprise. And no, I'm deeply concerned about Smithfield Foods. When you think about food security being national security, why would we ever cede control of an enormous sector of American agriculture to a global adversary like China? And of course, China loves it because they can outsource the waste that comes from these factory farms to the United States. We can outsource zoonotic disease threats, a pig and avian flu virus, which in 2009 was a major threat in the United States. There are so many elements of this that are extremely dangerous. And frankly, I'm shocked that many Republican lawmakers who talk about being tough on China are just genuflecting to China by supporting the EATS Act.
I want to circle back a bit to this issue of food safety, because I think that this is about the safety of our food supply, of our meat supply, of our dairy supply, because animals living in these unsanitary, crowded conditions really become so much more susceptible to zoonotic diseases that get passed to human beings, and pathogens like Salmonella and E. coli, and even a lot of our pandemics can be traced back to the way we raise meat.
Well, you said it very well, and I'll just add to that by noting that we cannot have confidence in our U.S. Department of Agriculture and our U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Those are the two principal regulatory agencies that oversee food safety in the United States, and they're both incredible examples of industry capture. I mean, USDA is an extension of the factory farming industry, and the United States has food safety standards, but there are millions and millions of people sickened every year with salmonella poisoning and a wide range of other foodborne pathogens. And some of that is a derivative of these intensive confinement conditions. When you keep animals stressed, overcrowded, in generally unhealthy circumstances, you're going to create more ripe conditions for disease to spread. I mean, when you have a healthy animal, his or her immune system is more robust. Factory farming is a prescription for the spread of disease. So we cannot trust these federal agencies because they are captured by industry and Congress has not passed laws. Rather than having the EATS Act, we should have a national policy against gestation crates. The Congress should be doing the exact opposite thing that it's proposing through the EATS Act. We should be giving more space to these animals. We should be saying, if you're going to raise these animals for food, the least you can do is give them some decent treatment before they're sent to slaughter. And I think what we've seen with factory farming is that, you know, every day can be miserable for the animals, not just the day of slaughter.
I want to pivot a bit here and talk about the people who are on the front lines of this, the farmers. Is it really more expensive for them to give animals more space? I wanted to also mention that Senator Grassley of Iowa, who is one of the main sponsors of the EATS Act, he says that these state laws like Prop 12 that mandate more space for animals make it more expensive for farmers and consumers and really stifle competition. Is any of that accurate?
Well, you know, Senator Grassley is kind of a marvel in some ways. I mean, he's 90 years old and he's still serving in Congress. So
yeah.
I will say, though, that he's ill-informed about Prop 12 and the broader marketplace when it comes to pork sales. And we at Animal Wellness Action and the Center for a Humane Economy, the two groups that I serve as president for, we did an analysis. In fact, we being two of our agricultural veterinarians. So we've been slowly seeing over these last two decades a transition away from intensive confinement in the form of gestation crates. And we have now nearly 50% of the 6 million sows that are raised in the United States, those are the ones who are kept in the gestation crates, are out of these crates.
I do want to clarify, when you say they're out of the gestation crates, this does not mean that they are frolicking happily in a pasture out of doors. Their lives are still very exactly. confined, but at least they can move.
Exactly. So it could be you could have multiple systems. You could have them in a group 10 in a very large, you know, industrial type facility, or they could be, you know, out in a pasture setting and living in hoop barns, and the hoop barns would protect them from the elements. So there are a wide range of systems, but as you say, the common feature is at least they get to move around, at least a little bit. So we have half of the animals out of those intensive confinement crates right now. California and Massachusetts represent just about, you know, 10% of, well, I shouldn't even say that. It's closer to 8% of all pork that is grown in the U.S. or animals raised and killed for pork. And the U.S. goes to California and Massachusetts, because not only does the pork industry supply 50 U.S. states and 6 U.S. territories, but we ship pork in the United States to 139 countries. I mean, our number one trading partner there is Mexico, and then China is second. So we're shipping one-third of all U.S. produced pork to foreign markets. So when you factor that in, and then you factor in exemptions in Prop 12, and then question 3 was the Massachusetts measure. That was the name of the measure, the designation of the measure in that state, which also passed. That was in 2016. So California and Massachusetts, to comply with Prop 12 and question 3, the extreme anti-confinement standards, anti-confinement standards that were established, represents just 6% of all U.S. produced pork. And I mentioned that 50% of U.S. produced pork coming from animals already out of crates. So Senator Grassley, going back to him, saying, oh, California is trying to impose their will on Iowa pork producers. Not one Iowa pork producer, if he or she does not want to, needs to change, because thousands of other pork producers already have, and they can accommodate California and Massachusetts today. So the whole thing is a contrivance. It's a terrible exaggeration, and it's really about ideology. They're trying to make the claim that somehow this is an imposition on them, when it's not an imposition on anyone. It's a market opportunity for the thousands of farmers who have already turned away from extreme confinement. This is about their ideology. It's about the fact that they don't want any state to impose these policies, because they fear that more of this is going to be done and that they're going to have to change down the line. But their whole narrative right now is, oh my God, the poor farmer in Iowa. Wrong. Thousands of farmers in Iowa already don't do this. Factory farming was an example of human innovation divorced from conscience. Now, I think what we need is human innovation attached to conscience. I'm not saying we should go back to a 1930s style agricultural production model. We should be having a 21st century model, and we can use our human creativity and our incredible capacity for innovation to deliver food to people that doesn't leave animals in such a terrible state of distress.
We've been talking to Wayne Pacelli, president of Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action. For In Depth and KBOO News, I'm Michelle Coppola.
Listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO